It's Thursday, January 30, 2014. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. When President Obama delivered the State of the Union address on Tuesday night, what perhaps was most important is not what happened, but what didn't happen. In retrospect, when you look at that address over against the historic occasion of the State of the Union address, several things immediately come to mind. One of them is the diminished status of oratory in American culture. Speeches used to matter more. They mattered a lot more because speeches were motion. They were political motion. They were moments. They were media attentive moments. And yet what really happened on Tuesday night was that America yawned even as they watched the President of the United States deliver a rather tedious State of the Union address. In stating it that way, I do not mean particularly to point to President Obama in contrast to other recent presidents. The presidency itself has been diminished in terms of its oratory force. You look back to well-known, very influential, culture-shaping presidential speeches. If you're looking for one, you have to go back a long time. And that's because America has moved from the age of the speech to the age of the soundbite. The other thing you saw on Tuesday night is that the speech is actually part of a larger media event with competing voices and competing messaging. You also saw that it is indeed what the Romans of old would call a spectacle. It was intended to have certain applause lines, to have certain effects and responses, and if the president didn't get what he wanted, he waited until he got it. And, of course, what you're looking at is the fact that oratory has been replaced once again with the soundbite and with the sensationalism of the media moment. The reality of the diminished presidency was also made clear by the fact that President Obama was delivering this address in the sixth year of his two-term presidency. A two-term presidency always, at least customarily, tends to be very weak at the end, and President Obama's position is weaker in the sixth year. That's not all that unusual. When we think of two terms for an American president, we need to keep in mind that that second term is never what it appears to be when it starts. When he was reelected in the year 2004, President George W. Bush described that he had momentum going into office that he would translate into a vast reformulation of Social Security and other major programs. None of that happened. President Obama spoke, in effect, to the diminished expectations of his second term when he went to the floor of the House on Tuesday night and announced a year of action that actually amounted to very little promise of action. There are so many things going on here, and there will be varied political analyses offered, but from the perspective of history and from the Christian worldview that looks at leadership as an essential function of human flourishing, that looks to government with limited but very important responsibilities, what took place on Tuesday night was largely a political irrelevance, not something that's likely to be remembered in any historical context, if even over the next several days. Evidence of that came in Wednesday's major newspapers across the country, from the Washington Post to the New York Times to the Los Angeles Times to USA Today to the Wall Street Journal, in which the State of the Union had front page placement but almost no major content inside the front section of America's leading newspapers. A couple of very interesting insights did come if you looked at the lead stories on the State of the Union in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. Writing in the New York Times, Carl Hulse wrote this: "A man who entered the White House yearning for sweeping achievements finds himself 5 years later threatening an end run around gridlock on Capitol Hill by using executive orders, essentially acknowledging both the limits of his ability to push an agenda through Congress and the likelihood that future accomplishments would be narrow." In the Wall Street Journal, Carol Lee and Peter Nicholas wrote, "President Obama, seeking to restore confidence in his leadership, set a goal in a State of the Union address Tuesday of using executive power to narrow the gap between rich and poor and speed up the country's economic recovery. Mr. Obama's speech," they wrote, "was essentially a manifesto designed to inject new vigor into his languishing agenda and guide his presidency through the partisan divide in the Capitol," end quote. By doing a search of similar moments in American presidencies, you'll discover that the major media said things at least similar in tone and in substance to other presidents, both Democrat and Republican, when they were delivering State of the Union addresses at this point in the second term of a presidency. But of our concern should be what made President Obama's speech unique. It was his straightforward acknowledgement that the political process has largely come to an end, to a standstill on bigger issues. As a matter of fact, of the huge issues the president did address, immigration may be the only major issue that really has the promise of bipartisan congressional action and thus delivering some legislation that could arrive at the president's desk for a signature. That's the one exception to the rule, being that the political process is not really pointing to any major legislative achievement or policy achievement for the president in this year. At least part of that is out of the president's control. You're looking at a situation in which the political dynamic is shifting to the 2014 elections. The president is largely going to be a bystander to those, and by the time those elections take place, the big political momentum will be for the 2016 presidential race. He will still be president of the United States. He will still have all the authority invested in the presidency in the United States Constitution. But this president, like most presidents, finds himself in his second term recognizing that he will be, to a far greater extent than he or the American public imagined when they reelected him, a bystander to the political process. That's where President Obama's speech on Tuesday night gets really interesting, because to an extent never before experienced by an American president, this president said to the American people, "I'm going to go around Congress and use executive authority, executive orders, and the power of my pen and persuasion to get certain things done." Two insights from that. Number one, if he gets much done, it will be dangerous. That's true whether it is a conservative or a liberal in the White House, whether it is a Republican or a Democrat. The separation of powers, which is at the heart of the American system of government, is something that is deeply fueled by Christian conviction. Those founders of the American Republic understood that our constitutional order had to take into effect the grave danger in a sinful world of concentrating too much authority and power in a single individual or even a single branch of government. Our government is divided to keep despotism from happening. As Montesquieu, the French political philosopher, said, "When you have executive and legislative authority in the hands of one individual, it is a recipe for autocracy." The nation's opinion writers, getting to the president's address, pointed out two things in response to that. Number one, this president seems intent on using executive orders wherever he can. And one of the places he mentioned was in federal contracts. The president says he will unilaterally raise the minimum wage. But as it turns out, there may be almost no one at present covered by the president's executive order. So what's happening here? What President Obama contemplates is exactly what the framers of the U.S. Constitution sought to avoid. And yet, at the end of the day, even those who share the president's political agenda recognize the inherent limitations of trying to operate by executive order. These limitations are at least two. Number one, there is actually only a very small area of the government that is ruled by executive orders and thus can be governed in that way. Most of what takes place in terms of our government's reach is under the control of Congress, where it actually constitutionally must be. But the second thing is this, and that is, if you rule by executive order, everything you do can be almost immediately undone. Two recent examples of that. When President Clinton came into office in 1993, he was elected in 1992, he was inaugurated in January of 1993, one of the first things he did was to sign four executive orders reversing four executive orders of the Reagan and Bush administrations. In other words, in just a moment, what had been done by executive order from 1980 to 1992 was swept away in just a matter of minutes in 1993. And the same thing happened in January of 2009 when President George W. Bush left office. By the way, President George W. Bush had used executive orders to shift, if not to reverse, executive orders of his predecessor, President Clinton. In other words, as president, you can do some things by executive order. But those things turn out to be more narrow than even you may think and promise. And at the end of the day, every single one of them is reversible. All this points to the inherent wisdom of the separation of powers in the United States Constitution, something that was fueled not only by political pragmatism, but by theological conviction. Speaking of the intersection of political philosophy and worldview, a very interesting testimony comes in the pages in recent days of the Financial Times, a major newspaper published in England. The article is by Larry Seedentop, a fellow of Keble College at Oxford University and author of the book Inventing the Individual. He writes an article entitled Remember the Religious Roots of Liberal Thought. It's a very interesting article. The use of the word liberal in this case reminds us that that word applies in more than one context with more than one meaning. In this context, Professor Seedentop is speaking of the Western liberal tradition. That's the tradition that leads to democracy, the understanding of the importance of the individual and of individual citizenship. A government by the people, of the people, for the people, that is the epitome of that kind of liberal thought. In that sense, all Americans are liberal. And yet what he's writing about is the persistent temptation of so many modern people to suggest that modern liberal thought must have emerged from a secular context, Because, after all, its religious background, its specifically Christian content, is now an embarrassment to modern secularists. Professor Siedentop writes that that is a grave mistake because it misses the fact that it was the Christian church in particular that gave importance to the individual. He writes that ancient societies, including ancient Rome, were societies built around the importance of the family, and the only person in the family who was of political importance was the father, or the paterfamilias. He writes, quote, "It was the Christian movement that began to challenge this understanding. Pauline belief in the equality of souls in the eyes of God, the discovery of human freedom and its potential, created a point of view that would transform the meaning of society. This began to undercut traditional inequalities of status. It was nothing short of a moral revolution, and it laid the foundation for the social revolution that followed. The individual," he writes, "gradually displaced the family, tribe, or caste as the basis of social organization." End quote. Rather than lie about our past, suggesting that these modern liberal values emerged from a secular context, which, by the way, didn't even exist, Professor Siedentop concludes his article with this line, quote, "We should acknowledge the religious sources of liberal secularism. That would strengthen the West, making it better able to shape the conversation of mankind." End quote. A very important piece of testimony from a periodical mostly concerned with economics, but a periodical, a very influential one on the international stage, that understands that economics is at its base about far more than economics. Meanwhile, that other definition of liberalism, that other context, also comes into play, and very importantly so in our times. These days, when most people speak of liberal, they mean it over against the opposite, which is conservative. Political conservatism has been that political ambition and intuition that has believed that there are certain institutions that must be conserved, certain political habits, certain moral traditions that must be conserved if society is to survive and human beings are to flourish. The liberal tradition, on the contrary, has argued that there is an arc of moral development, of political progression, they call themselves often progressives, that means that we should continue to push past the limitations of other habits, of previous traditions, of existing structures, in order to liberate humanity for a new form of society. One of the most interesting questions, one of the most important questions about our current moment, is whether or not we are entering a new liberal era. For most of the last half of the 20th century, liberalism was in ascendancy, from the late 1930s at least until about 1980. But measured and marked by the election of President Reagan in 1980, America was understood to have entered a new, more conservative moment. Now, many on the left especially are cheering what they say is the arrival of a new liberal age. Evidence of this comes in the Washington Post on January the 17th when columnist Steve Rosenthal writes about the liberalization of America. He writes this, "Not too long ago, everyone was declaring American politics a lost cause for progressives. The religious right supposedly had a stranglehold on elections. Then it was the Tea Party that had the political establishment, initially Democrats and Republicans, quaking. The media and the general public took hold of a narrative parroted by conservative candidates and opinion leaders. The United States was a center-right nation." He then goes on, "But after two consecutive elections, in which the Democratic candidate for president garnered more than 50% of the vote, a 1-2 punch, last achieved by Franklin Roosevelt, it is worth questioning that assumption. The country is getting more diverse, and as the population of white voters shrinks, so too does the conservative base. As demographics shift, so do political preferences, in this case, toward the left. A close examination," he writes, "of U.S. attitudes in the past decade plus reveals that the United States is steadily becoming more progressive." End quote. That's a very important political analysis that obviously has deep worldview implications. Is America shifting from being center-right to being center-left? You know, I think, if anything, Steve Rosenthal's argument is actually behind the times. I think America shifted to being a basically center-left nation sometime over the last 10 years, not the last 10 months or the last 10 weeks. I think that kind of moral change is made very clear in the fact that if you compare 2004, when President George W. Bush was reelected president, he was reelected president at least in part, as people in both parties would agree, on the strength of voter sentiment to protect natural marriage, the union of a man and a woman. It was ballot issues in states such as Ohio that led voters to the polls in numbers even greater than would be expected for a presidential election. And those who were going to the polls to vote for those marriage amendments, all of them passed, by the way, did so at the same time that they voted in an overwhelming correlation for President George W. Bush. Fast forward to 2012. Every single issue before the ballot on the state level on the issue of same-sex marriage failed. In other words, the political direction and the political momentum had shifted markedly. The candidate running for president in 2004 was a stalwart defender of marriage as the union of a man and a woman. The candidate running for re-election in 2012 was a candidate who had, to use his own word, evolved into the political support of legalizing same-sex marriage. The distance of time between 2004 and 2012 is, as you're marking your calendar, 8 years. In 8 years, America went from having every state that contemplated the issue vote to support a ban on same-sex marriage to a situation in which not one of those was successful in 2012. Perhaps it will not surprise you that when Steve Rosenthal tries to make his case, he points to two issues in particular, and those issues are the legalization of marijuana and same-sex marriage. And he's right. The big question is, how far has America shifted from being center-right to being center-left? And of course, there is no absolute assurance that center-left will not grow even further left. And there are those on the liberal side who hope that that is exactly what is happening. From the Christian perspective, something to note is that there has to be an underlying explanation for why this is taking place. Steve Rosenthal says that that underlying dynamic is demographics. It's a change in the racial and ethnic composition of the American electorate. I do not deny that that makes a difference. But I would argue that the overwhelming issue at stake is the secularization of the larger culture. That is the fastest change in worldview, because many of those people who are not a part of the old American demographic, but rather the new, share a worldview that is not secular. It is the larger movement in the culture toward the secularization of public discourse and the public square that I think alone can explain the velocity of this kind of moral shift, a political shift, as the Washington Post now makes very clear in this article, from America as center-right to center-left. Remember that this weekend brings the first installment in Ask Anything Weekend Edition. To call in with your question in your voice, just call 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. We'll look forward to that program being released on Saturday morning. And until then, give us a call. Tell your friends. Let them call as well. We want to hear your question in your voice. We'll get to that program on Saturday. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.